Hello and welcome to RT Radio 1's The Rolling Wave podcast with me, Aoife Nic Cormick. Harper Kathleen Loughnan recently released a book and a CD of a selection of the music collected by Patrick O'Neill in South Tipperary and Kilkenny. O'Neill lived from 1765 to 1832, and so he was collecting music in Ireland at the end of the 18th century and into the beginning of the 19th century. So this is the second volume of the work of Patrick O'Neill, which Kathleen Loughnan has published, and she's previously worked on the music notated by other collectors and written by harp composers from the 17th and 18th century. So she really does know her way around this material. Many listeners, of course, would know Kathleen's music from the work she has done over the years with the band Thurdon with Mary Bergen and Dervil Stondhun. I met Kathleen during the summer at the Willie Clancy Summer School. She's run the harp classes there since 2005, and she was just handing over that job to Harper Gráinne Hambly. So we met and we spoke about Patrick O'Neill and this second CD and book of his manuscripts, and we started off our chat with a piece of music, which is introduced here by Kathleen Loughnan.
I'd like to play an air from the Patrick O'Neill's manuscript. It's in other manuscripts as well, but it's an air I really love called Catchlin Triel. And it has some sort of parallels with Éamon an Cnoic. You can kind of hear something of that. So my sense is that the air was there and that the words were put later to the air. Well, Patrick O'Neill was born in 1765 and died around 1832. He was one of the O'Neills who were very proud of their legacy to the Northern Earls of Tyrconnell. And they came down, there was a lot of O'Neills who came down after the Battle of Kinsale. And, of course, they lost most of their lands. They had vast acres in Tipperary, Kilkenny. And there's still a very distinguished sort of grave stone, big grave to them in one of the small towns around Owning. So they obviously were a significant family. And after Cromwell, though, they were on the wrong side of the Cromwellian Wars, and they lost all their lands, and they were dispatched to somewhere out somewhere near North Galway. And they didn't stay very long, so they must have had great connections because they went to Rome and France. And, you know, it's quite extraordinary the journeys they made. And then they came back. Some of them came back. And because they had good connections with the Norman Irish in the area, in their own area, they got something like 80 acres of land. And so Patrick O'Neill basically was a respectable farmer and a miller, and he was very, very scholarly. I was fascinated when I was reading Owen O'Neill's book, The Vale of Ivone, which is a marvellous read for anybody interested in a local large history of a family. So they were very scholarly. He spoke Irish, he spoke French, he spoke Latin and some Greek. And so he also wrote for one of the newspapers, which I haven't gone into at all. I mean, there's so much work to be done on this man. He started collecting when he was about 20. So he was collecting a little bit before 1792, before the big harp festival. And one of the things that Nicholas Carlin wrote a very interesting article in the Peabury magazine. But where I came across him was in the Irish Times, a small ad in the Irish Times where I saw that the 8 manuscripts were bought by the National Library. And I got very excited because I'm South North Tipperary. So it was kind of, I was really interested, so I went to the library and got all 8 of them out, and, you know, had a great browse. And like most of the music in it is an awful lot of dance music, and mazurkas and polkas and light opera, and European music, a lot of Scottish music. So thus this particular selection I made is half Scottish, half Irish, and what I was really, for me, what was really very interesting was Petrie and Bunting both were commissioned basically to write down Irish music because there was such concern at that stage of losing so much. But what he did was recorded the music of his that was popular, socially popular among the Norman Irish as well as the Gaelic Irish. So they made their own of so much of the music that had come in from Scotland, England and Europe. So he was an extraordinary man, really. He didn't marry until he was 60, which I suppose was a very good plan on his part to be able to pursue. Dedicate the time, exactly, to collecting.
I'm always interested in the thing of collecting and, you know, the methodologies, because as you say, if he was sort of notating the popular music of the time or the current music, it wasn't necessarily that he was going to people's houses and writing down what they were playing. Or do we know anything about how he might have conducted his collecting work?
The only thing we know is that there are various handwriting styles in the manuscripts. One of them was his son, Cornelius O'Neill, and he belonged to a very interested and interesting group of people in his area. So I think he got tunes from manuscripts, and I think he would have been very aware of all the manuscripts that were coming out in Britain and in Scotland at the time. So I think he was very, very aware of what was going on. And so I think he had many, many, many sources of tunes, and he just wrote, and then his family kind of continued to write down the music. I was very touched when I went down to Owning, and I went to the mill, you know, that he had, and his met not direct O'Neills, but people who were related to him by marriage, and they were telling me about the last two, his grandsons. One of them was a fiddle player and the other was a writer and a philosopher. So I was intrigued that these two men carried on the family traditions, you know, especially the traditions of Patrick O'Neill. And it was very poignant because they knew they belonged to an old family, and they kind of kept to themselves a bit. And there's a very poignant story that this lady told me, that one Sunday when one of them went to Mass, that the house was burgled and a lot of things were stolen, and God only knows what was stolen, because they changed nothing. They had the open fire, these two men. They didn't marry, and they, you know, kind of preserved what they could. So he never left the house after that. And he was in his 80s at this stage.
Going back to Patrick himself, was he a musician?
He was a piper, a singer, and I think possibly a fiddle player as well, and a great storyteller. And he also wrote some poetry. So this, I mean, like I've only, you know, I keep telling people, this is a tiny dip, what I've done, into what is an extraordinary life's work, you know. And there's his Irish writing as well is stored in Ring College in Waterford, so that's another area of study. And then he wrote for the, as I said, for the local Clonmel, I think, or Carrick and Shure, whatever the name of the paper was. So that, you know, so like Nicholas Carlin said to me, he wouldn't be interested in doing anything until there's a total full. You know, I was thinking it would be fascinating to make a documentary of this man's work, but he said there's so much work to be done before that.
It's a PhD calling, I think, actually, PhD. For somebody.
Exactly. I prefer to play the music.
The music, or the arrangements that you have done of these tunes in this new publication that you have, they're obviously for harp. But the music as he was writing it down or notating it would have been not for any particular instrument, presumably, or no?
I remember reading a survey that was done, I think, in the early 1830s in the south of Ireland. And there was a list of all the instruments that were played in the area, and there were no harps. So from that point of view, like, And that kind of made me have a look at the, especially at the Scottish old tunes like Daunt and Me and the Birks of Endermay and some of these. I was able to find references to them in Scottish magazines. And my hunch, but I'll never know, my hunch is that those tunes possibly existed in the harping period up to the 1600s, mm-hmm. and that then, like Robbie Burns and all the poets, are always looking for attractive airs to put to popularize their words. So you know, so they took on so many variants, you know, and I'm just hoping that these will take on many other variants in the hands of all the wonderful musicians around. So.
And what about so you mentioned that particular area, but the context for the harping tradition at the time that he was collecting, where was harp music at in Ireland at that time?
During his time, well, I was talking to somebody who's doing research at the moment on the harp in the 19th century, and there were harpers here and there, but very spread out, and there's somebody doing very interesting research at the moment on trying to source some of the harpers that did survive, you know, so that perhaps some of the music did carry on the pipes, or sorry, on the harp, and then the pipers and the fiddle players, you know, took over some of that fantastic material.
We heard Kathleen Treal earlier on. You might choose another tune maybe from, because you have a CD which accompanies the book.
Right, yeah. Second collection from, I did a first selection about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. I love the Birks of Endermay, which are the birch trees of Invermay in the north of Perthshire. So, and I think it's a lovely tune, and it has a kind of slightly Baroque feel to it, you know. So, yeah. I think that would be a nice one to play.
Just before we hear it, the arrangements that you did in this book, obviously for harp, was there much work in sort of adapting them and working them into these arrangements in the collection?
No, my way of working is to completely live in a tune for a long time. I don't care how long it takes, to get a sense of the heart in the tune, the kind of emotional energy or vitality. And really, it's only when I can sense that. And like, I've done a lot of work on Carolyn and a lot of work on Thomas and William Connellan. So I suppose that work would have kind of given me some insight as to how to interpret, because they, you know, especially the Connellan brothers would have had a lot of links with Scotland and came and went, you know, and brought a lot of the music over with them, you know. And then after that, in terms of arranging, I do it all by ear, you know. I never wrote anything down for years, except people when I recorded them said, well, write down the arrangements. It took me longer to write them down than it did to learn them. But I tried to find the energy, tried to... I love the kind of counterpoint harmonic sort of approach to the more Baroque kind of, like a Carolyn kind of pieces or Connellan. And they lend themselves to that sort of arrangement in my head. And then the slow airs, I'd always be very spare in the arrangement.
The Birks of Endermay, they're played by Kathleen Knocknan, and I'm here with Kathleen. We're at the Willie Clancy Summer School, and we're having a conversation about her new publication, Patrick O'Neill's Manuscripts, Volume 2. This is Volume 2, obviously. Give me an idea of the scale. I think you mentioned you took 8 out. You read there were 8 of them in the first place. So give me an idea of the scale of the collection. How big is it? And, you know, how much is still there to mine?
Oh, there's an awful lot there to mine. You know, there's 8 little books, some of them small, some of them, you know, in one of the manuscripts, there's a lot of kind of opera and light opera on one side, and then he writes the notes when obviously when he ran out of paper, or some of his friends who were collecting ran out of paper. So there's all sorts of bits and pieces, and sometimes it's hard enough to make some of it out, but there's so much, so much. I would recommend any musician to have a look.
And would he have published in his time, would he have published these manuscripts or just collected them?
Just collected them, I think, you know. And we're very lucky that they came up for sale. The National Library bought them, I think something like 80,000. But it's fantastic. Fantastic to have it, you know.
And do you know where they were, pre-National Library?
I'm not too sure where they were. There was this Colonel O'Neill who wrote The Golden Veil of Ivone, wrote it in Irish first, and then it was translated, and it's really well worth reading. And so he was very, very proud of Patrick O'Neill and the work he did. And I gave a talk on the first selection in the Piper's Club. And a son of Colonel O'Neill turned up, which was very interesting, actually, to meet him. So, you know, they were a proud family. They definitely had a great sense of themselves and their importance, sort of.
This is one collection, but you mentioned Bunting, you mentioned Petrie, and you obviously have an interest in those collections. What does it give to your own music or to your own understanding of music to delve into these collections, do you think?
Well, like going back, I mean, I studied social science and psychology and things like that, and sort of there was years in my 20s when I did very little harping. But when I came back to Galway in 1982, I had two boys, Cormac and Paul, and I took the harp out of the case and kept it in the kitchen. And I had been listening to Grainne Yates brought out a fantastic Féile na Gcrichtearraí back in the 70s, and I was so excited when I got hold of that, because she had delved into so much of the harp music, and I just said, this is amazing, this is the way I want to go. And then, you know, lots of little things happened. I mean, I met John Ryan at about 85, but it was wonderful who I met here during the week, Liam Lewis, beautiful fiddle player. Absolutely beautiful fiddle player. And I haven't seen him for years, and he turned up at the opening here on Sunday. And Liam was playing in the Crane one Sunday, and he says, "We'll play the hornpipe. Doesn't sound like a hornpipe." And he mentioned Molly Halfpenny, Molly McAlpin. And immediately, because I'd come across the name, I'd remembered. And I went back and, of course, found Molly McAlpin, beautiful air. And so that was another tease and a coaxing onwards and on whatever bits of research I've done.
You're originally from North Tipperary, outside Nina, and who put the harp in your hand in the first place, or how did you come to it?
My mother. My father was the musical person in our family. He played piano by ear, and he had a lovely touch in the way he played the bass of songs and, you know, in tunes. And I often think when I'm arranging sometimes the more spare versions, I think I'm hearing him still. So that was big, and a big impact on us. And we sang all the time, you know, the car hit us singing all the time, everywhere. So then I went to boarding school in Limerick, and my mother asked me would I like to study harp. And they had just started the harp in 61 or 62, 96, one. So as you hear, I'm ancient, really ancient. So we started. So there was a wonderful nun there. She was 80 or something, but she was a fantastic musician. And she bought a tutor, and she taught me from a tutor.
Like a book?
Book. And then...
So she would have been she would have been one step ahead of you, sort of.
That's all. But she was a fantastic pianist.
Yeah.
And at the time she was doing amazing research on John Field, and published something, you know, and she was trying to finish it before she passed on. But she said a lovely thing to me that I've often told people. She was cross like at times, but she'd say, "You never strike a note, you take the note." Mm. it said everything to me about, you know, when I was too young at the time, but it stayed in my head. And when I'm teaching, I know when somebody's hitting and banging, and I know when somebody is listening to the sound, you know. You never strike the note, you take the notes.
It's a nice way of describing, isn't it? Like you're coaxing the music out in some way.
Yeah, and having reverence for what's in the music, you know.
So John Field, would she have been teaching you classical music then, or traditional music?
Classical music and songs mostly, you know. It was back then, it was mostly songs, and I used to sing. I couldn't sing now, so too many late nights. But
not this week anyway.
No. But I used to with the harp, you know. So that was the kind of style then. And what changed that for me was my brother was going out with Eileen Begley. When they were courting, they brought me everywhere with them, and I went. And so I spent a lot of time with Seamus Begley, Eileen and Vincent, going around to small kind of venues in Kerry. And in those days, he was very, very shy. Really, you wouldn't believe it because, you know, he became such a wild man. But he sang in all those lovely airs, all those lovely... No, he sang everything. He sang Jim Reeves to Band of Atlanta to, you know, all the lovely airs. So that was a huge education for me. And I had come from Ring as well, and Nicholas Tobin used to sing in church on Sunday, and I loved going to Mass. I was the only one, I think, at the school. Anyway, I loved going because he stood up in the loft and sang, you know. So I was very lucky to have those sorts of encounters, you know.
And then Sean Ryan, you mentioned, in Galway, and Liam Lewis, and then Dúradán, of course.
Yeah. Eamon Brophy and Liam were very generous with their music, you know. So I love, and of course Sean Ryan is amazingly generous. And I used to go out tentatively because I'd only come back into the music, you know, in my early 30s, having had a, you know, pretty good foundation. But they were great. They welcomed the harp, and Eamon Brophy was, I did a certain amount of work with Eamon, and on the previous collection, or was it on the Connellans, he sang a few of these lovely songs, Molly St. George, and Sean Garvey, of course, as well, sang Irian Lee from the Connellan. So I had very good friends in music, and very sadly some of them have gone, like Sean Garvey, and Ali Quinn was very important to me in my musical life because he loved harp. And he loved, because he was doing so much percussive stuff with De Donnan. So he was so clever at weaving in and out of the kind of bass that I do myself. So that was a very rich time, really rich, fun time.
When you play tunes, say, I mean, not the airs and not the slower tunes, when you play the jigs and the reels, say, with other musicians, what kind of a style do you go for there? Do you play the tune, or do you try and weave in and out, as you were saying Alec might have done, or what do you do?
I've worked so much on my own that I've never, and it was a very busy life, I've never really sat enough in sessions to become a good accompanist. And the reason why I say that is I think you have to know every tune inside out to be a good accompanist. And he was brilliant because he was doing that all his life. Melody was my big thing, you know, and then supporting the melody in what I did with the bass, you know. So really, any jigs and reels I play, I would learn them very well, and then do, you know, work out the arrangement that would, again, bring out the lift, the life, and the hidden rhythms, I suppose.
You took a long break from music. You said you only came back to it in your 30s. Was that just life and responsibilities and everything else, or was
it? And I mean, like I come from farming people in Tipperary, and music would have just been part of life. Nobody would have had, and I would have had no idea that I would end up doing much more music than anything else. You know, I gave up. I did some when I came to Ireland. I worked in adoption as a social worker in the west of Ireland but then I had to give that up because Dúradán, we started around 1988, about then, and I couldn't take on any adoption case because you'd have to see it through. Wouldn't be fair. So I then focused on the music and family, of course. and the ups and downs and family.
And how did Dervil get together?
Funny story. I mean, it was a scream, really. Dervil and myself had played in the castles when we were students, and they were great jobs then, much better than picking stones or picking pears or picking anything.
How do you mean played in the castles? Like played for tourists? Yeah, okay.
But they did a whole, and Napogue, there was a whole kind of pageant, you know. So they were great jobs. They provided us with strings and we had accommodation and everything. We had a great time. So Dervil I knew from then. And then when I came back to Galway, Dervil and myself started playing a few tunes with the intention of just playing at a few weddings or something like that. And then we played in what's the name of the place again? Oh, in one of the towns in North Galway. There was a father, there was a priest there who was really interested in drama. So he asked Dervil and myself would do something, and Mary was playing there as well. And Mary went to, I was playing the Polonaise, which is one of the first tunes we did on Dervil from the Anna Magdalena Bach book. And it's a lovely piece. I remember playing it one time in the session, and Frankie Gavin was there, and he said, "That's lovely. That's a lovely Carolyn tune." I said, "No, it's not a Carolyn tune, but same period." And Mary said, "I'd love to play that music." And Dervil and myself looked at each other as if to say, "She's gone off her head." Mary, who was, you know, as you know, like a diamond, sparkling diamond in her playing, so we got together. She said, "No, I really want to play." And she still loves playing this mixture, because again, I suppose, playing jigs and reels all her life, you know. So that's really how we started. And then we, in 1990, we won the National Entertainment Award. Nobody was more surprised than ourselves. And, you know, things went from there. So we travelled then for, you know, a good few years, you know. So I was very lucky, Aoife, to get a head start on all these fantastic harpers that I'm surrounded with now. It's amazing.
Hadn't realised that the harp classes at the Willie Clancy Summer School only began in 2005, which I must be showing my age now, but it doesn't seem that long ago. Was there a reason they weren't there before? You've been running them since then.
Yeah, I've been running them for the last 18 years, and I've just handed over now to the wonderful Gráinne Hamley, who will do a fantastic job. And she, you know, she does a huge amount of teaching, and Gráinne is very musical and also very, very, she'll be a far better organiser than I ever was. But I used to bring Cormac down, you see, for piping lessons when he was 11, 12, older, and he was fired up. He wouldn't talk to me on the way back to Galway in the car because he was playing all the tunes and the whistles. He was just fired. And Mirrors, I used to chat with Mirrors and say, why don't we have the harp here? He said, "Catherine, I'd love to have the harp. The only reason why we don't have it is we've no room." And then one year they got three porta cabins, and he said, "We'll start the harp." So we started with three porta cabins and three rooms in the town. The six people that I still have with me were teaching. So it was very lucky because we're all very good players and very good teachers. And then we went from 26 students enrolling to this year 50. You know, harps, you know, it was just amazing. And the concerts on the Monday night, Harry reminded me of this the other night. We had half that hall curtained off. So we had about a, you know, really good audience of around 80. Now there's over 200 every Monday. Massive turnout. I don't understand it myself.
And the young harpists who come, and I presume there are adults as well who come to the classes, but have they changed a lot over those years? You know, how
a lot of things have changed, Aoife. First of all, an awful lot of the young people are playing concertinas, especially. I don't understand what it is, but concertina players and harps abound around the place. But the wonderful thing, the wonderful change, I mean, I was lucky to meet the Begleys and various people, because I love something about the music, but nobody could show me how to do a triplet. So I had to. I worked out a system that nobody. I don't teach the same system because there's a better system now developed. But so I was dying to do something more more vibrant with the harp, but there was nobody. Kathleen Watkins and in Grania, it's really, but only two harpers I would have known in the country.
Mary O'Hara,
yeah, who was very musical. Yeah, you know, so. So it has changed dramatically. And the fact that so many are playing other traditional instruments, there's more money in the country as well. Mm. People are able to afford, families are able to afford instruments, you know, because they're all expensive. But that made a huge difference to the whole idiom of traditional music, because playing the other instruments, they had so much of the ornamentation, variation possibilities. And so it became a much more integrated part of the wider traditional culture. Mm. And that makes me really happy that the harp finally, because I remember in the early days you bring out a harp and people, oh no. But then if you played relatively decently, you were kind of accepted in one way or another.
And do you find with the young people playing the harp, like, are they listening to a very wide palette of music as well now? Because, you know, what you have available to you, to your ears now, to listen to is so vast. And how does that then play into the music that they're playing?
That's a difficult question to answer. But one of the things I find difficult as a teacher is to get people to slow down. They want everything immediately, you know, it's part of contemporary culture. And like in the earlier days when I was teaching, I was teaching Galway really since I came back, you know, and I would have been very strong on very good technique. Because when I was at school, the nun who taught me, there was no emphasis on, like, you relax the thumbs, because if you don't relax the thumbs, you have the tension all the way up here. So there's a lot of basic technique, very simple stuff, that you bring the fingers into the palm rather than this. So you see people, and it's very hard to correct bad position. Now, the marvellously musical person is going to find a way through. But it's so much easier if they start with, I keep telling them, carpenter needs sharpened tools. We need things not to develop strain and tensions and things like that.
We're nearly at the end here now, but just tell me in terms of men and women, because, you know, we started the conversation, we were talking about Patrick O'Neill and Bunting and Petrie and, you know, the Connellan brothers and all these men. And then suddenly it morphed into an instrument which was very much dominated by women, the harp. Have we got more men, or are there more boys and men who come to the classes?
It's still predominantly girls who are learning, and in America it's mainly the over 60s who are coming back and learning the harp. So Maeve Gilchrist, who's a niece of mine, is a very good harper, but she loves teaching in Ireland because she's all the young people, you know, at the festivals in America, you have a lot of. Which is wonderful. Senior citizens, retired people taking up harp.
Well, I walked by one of the harp classes yesterday and I saw a very small child perched on a box or on a stool or something with a tiny harp. So yeah, you're clearly getting the whole age range. Okay, well, look, thank you so much, Kathleen. We might finish with another tune from this CD.
Yeah, Daunt and Me is an interesting, a Scottish tune that has... somebody said to me the other, I think it was Leash Kelly, who said it's a little bit like Moran's Return. Do you remember that tune that Nulla Casey played? But it has the clipped kind of rhythm of the Scottish flavour, you know, the flavour that you get in some Scottish music. Cloud the Cauldron, I get a great fun out of that one because it's related to the tinsmiths. I remember the travellers coming out, the tinkers then, because of working with, and it's, you can hear the impact of people working the tinsmith, and it's like I'll Mend Your Pots and Kettles, oh, from Seamus Ennis, you know, the same sort of thing.
It's a great title.
Cloud the Cauldron, yeah. So Daunt and Me might be a nice one for you to finish. Yes.
Well, it's a beautiful collection, beautiful CD, and a beautiful cover as well. Tell me about the cover before we finish.
Paul is an architect, so having paid for fiddle lessons all his early life, I decided he owed me something, so he did the cover for me. So he put the bird sitting on the harp while I was hard working writing out the arrangements, and then when I recorded, he let it fly off. Take flight, exactly.
Gorgeous. Okay, we'll look at Kathleen Loughnan. Congratulations and thank you very much.
Thanks, Aoife. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to RTE Radio 1's The Rolling Wave podcast. For rights reasons, the music here is shorter than in the original broadcast, so if you'd like to hear the full music tracks, you can go to rte.ie/Radio 1 and then look for The Rolling Wave. So until the next time, Gura Míle Maithí, agus slán.